I ain't got no home, I'm just a roaming round. Just a wandering worker, I go from town to town. And the police make it hard wherever I may go. And I ain't got no home in this world anymore.
Money Radio, good afternoon. Thank you so much for joining us. It is a pleasure to welcome back Professor Price Fishback. He is a professor of economics at the University of Arizona, specializing in economic history and very specifically studying the political economy of Roosevelt's New Deal during the 1930s. And he has now come up with a new working paper, How Successful Was the New Deal? Professor Fishback, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me again.
That's got to be a really tough question to try and answer. How successful was the New Deal? In part because there are just so many variables to consider in trying to figure that out. Where did you really start this process?
Well, so the idea that we had was the following. We've been reading all these studies of the New Deal that had done kind of narrative stories about what was happening and just used some very simple statistics or even just ignored the statistics and just said, well, the New Deal was successful in this way or not in this way. Or they said that this is what the New Deal was supposed to do and, oh, well, it did it. And so one of the questions we had was, is that I did a lot of this work with Sean Cantor, who's at Florida State University now, but we started out together at the University of Arizona working on it. And we started thinking about, well, what kind of data would we need to actually check to see how successful the New Deal was? So we have some macroeconomic data that people had collected before, but our goal was to go out and collect as much detailed information at like the state level and the city level and the county level, and for even individual levels, and just try to see, well, what did it do? I mean, what did it do in these various places, and how much impact did it have? So the step we took was Sean started us down this path because he was at the University of Illinois Library and wandered into their stacks and found these mimeograph sheets that showed how much they spent on every program in the New Deal for every county in America. And so that's what started us down this path. And so we started collecting up all this information about what they spent in the New Deal, and then we started collecting information on just about every dimension we could think of like economics and social things. So we were trying to look at income and retail sales and manufacturing activity, birth rates and death rates, marital rates, all sorts of different types of things to try to see what the impact was.
This has to be an incredibly complex situation because you could look at, for example, federal spending versus state spending, and they were very different back in the 30s than they are today. And then you can look at the effects of private employment, public employment, and a different world in one area may affect the other. You may have public spending that may have some unintended consequences on private employment, for example.
Exactly. And so one of the things we found, we did a study at the state level where this was with Valentina Kochnevskaya, who I got interested in this even though she's from St. Petersburg, Russia. And what we did with that study was we actually looked at state incomes and we tried to estimate the multiplier. Everybody has gotten excited about the Keynesian multiplier again.
Sure.
After the Obama surplus that they tried to put in place in 2009. And so we thought that, well, if there's any a place where you expect to see a big multiplier effect, it would be in the 1930s, because you had such high unemployment that you had plenty of employment you could soak up without crowding out other parts of the economy. So Valentine and I spent a long time, almost 3 years, putting together data on how much they spent in each state on a variety of different programs. And then we summed it all up and looked at how much they spent. And so what we tried to do is the multiplier. When we're estimating the multiplier, the way to think about it is if the number comes out as being 1, that means that the federal spending came into the state and then it generated just a dollar of income. So it was like a pass-through. It created a dollar. A dollar was spent, you get a dollar of income.
Okay.
If it turns out to be like 1.5 or 2, which is a number that's constantly bandied about, then what that's saying is spend the dollar in the state and then the dollar passes through the dollar and also stimulates enough other activity that you add another dollar of activity. So the 2 means you get $2 for every $1 you spend. Now, the other possibility is that you could get crowding out. It might actually reduce how much people work or how much they spend on other things because they're already getting things from the government. So in that case, you might get a multiplier of 0.5, which means that federal government comes in and spends a dollar, income goes up by 50 cents, and it only goes up by 50 cents because it crowded out some other activity.
Okay,
so that's what we did. And so the number that we ended up with was that we did a whole bunch of estimation, and the number for the overall spending was actually one, right around one. And we tried all sorts of different ways to test the robustness of this and things like this. So you spend a lot of time in economics in the journals fighting about how robust your result is. And so you want it to be really robust. And that one seemed to be. We tried a lot of different ways and always came out to be about one. And so it looked like it was a pass-through. Now, there was one program, though, that actually seemed to do damage to the economy, and that was the AAA Farm Program. And what that was doing was, it's kind of similar, it was the beginning of our modern farm program, and what they started out doing was paying farmers to take land out of production.
Mm-hmm.
And the goal was to take the land out of production to raise farm prices. And it somewhat succeeded at doing that, but basically what it seemed to do actually was that a lot of land got taken out of production, and particularly in the South and other areas, a lot of people fired their tenants or eliminated their sharecroppers and reduced how many people they hired. And so it actually did a lot of damage to the lower end of the income distribution because a lot of people lost their positions.
So it hurt the really small farmer.
Yeah, really small farmer. So, and this is like sharecroppers and share tenants. And so they might be, the sharecropper was actually kind of like a worker who got paid a share of the crop. And so they actually, a lot of them lost their jobs or lost their positions and ended up either as farm workers or moving out of the area. So what you got was that the farmers who received the benefit payments got better off, but then what happened was there were all sorts of people at the lower part of the income distribution who were worse off, and so the net effect was actually slightly negative.
Was this what led to the start of the big corporate farm in America?
I'm not sure if I would tie that directly to it. It certainly contributed to this. One of the things that happened was there was a lot more mechanization on a lot of farms during the 1930s as a result of the program. Because, I mean, in the heart of the Depression, no one had hardly any money. So it's kind of hard to conceive that they'd actually start buying tractors and stuff, but the AAA money actually led to more mechanization during the 30s.
And at the same time, you talk about the negative consequences in the South with the small farmers. What about in the Dust Bowl area where there were such environmental problems that maybe taking some land out of production had a positive effect, possibly?
It could. And so there was a positive feature of the farm programs in the following sense, is that after it was the original AAA was declared unconstitutional in 1935, and the reason was it had a processing tax that the Supreme Court thought was unconstitutional. So they eliminated the processing tax, started over again, and in the new one, they emphasized conservation a lot more. And one of the features, I have some friends, Gary Labcap, who's at UC Santa Barbara, and Zainab Hansen, who's at Boise State, and they had done some work where they showed that some of the AAA, what they were doing was they were trying to put in like berms to prevent soil erosion mm-hmm. and do a variety of things like that. And as the farms got bigger, they had more incentives to actually do a lot more to put in things that would prevent dust from blowing over and things. And so what they found is that, you know, you had the huge Dust Bowl in the 30s. In the 1970s, you had basically the same environmental conditions you had before. A lot of drought, a lot of wind and things like that, but you didn't get the Dust Bowl this time because the farmers had all taken steps to prevent that kind of soil erosion.
Overall, we had things like the TVA, public roads, public works. Did infrastructure spending work?
Well, it worked. So there are different dimensions of thinking about this. We definitely built a lot of infrastructure during that time frame. A lot of it's pretty good infrastructure, too. I mean, you can see it all over the place because every county in America, they built sanitation facilities, they built roads, they built Sabino Canyon Road in Tucson. Mm-hmm. They do a variety of things like that. You walk around the University of Arizona and you can see WPA stamped into the sidewalks. Now, I think they've replaced them, but they just stamped it back WPA again. So there are a lot of these public works that they did. You know, the artist program gets a lot of attention. A lot of really interesting art came out of this. And so it did help to stave off the problems of the depression. It probably helped stimulate things. But it wasn't like this huge multiplier. You always hear about, you know, they always claim that the football stadium and the new baseball stadium are going to have a multiplier of 3 to 1. Well, that just doesn't happen. I mean, so what we're finding is multipliers of about 1. So it suggests that it does have positive effects, but it's not, you can't expect some big blown-up positive effect like 2 or 3 on those kind of things like this. And so the economy did recover. It took a long time for unemployment to drop, actually, and for employment to come back. But the overall real GDP per capita grew. In some ways, it was kind of like the recovery from the most recent recession. It took a long time for the unemployment rate to come back. And the employment rate still has not come back in the from the 2008-2009 recession. And so that's one worrisome feature of the current situation, is that employment seems to have dropped off quite a bit.
Now, what about areas like the home loan programs that were put into effect back then? We hear that that helped a lot of people avoid foreclosure. Was that a success, and what lessons can we learn from that?
Well, so that one actually was a situation where I don't think people realize just how bad a mortgage crisis we had during the 1930s. A lot of times they don't talk about the housing problems as a cause of the Great Depression. And one reason was that a lot of the mortgage crisis developed around 1931 and 32 after the economy started to fall apart. So what happened was you had all sorts of people who were in trouble on their mortgages, and they developed what's known as the Homeowners Loan Corporation. And it was a company, it was a corporation that could issue government bonds and then could use the government bonds to buy mortgages from the owner, from the lenders. And my colleague Jonathan Rose, who's at the Federal Reserve Board at Board of Governors in Washington, D.C., he did some studies where he showed that actually they paid full freight for those mortgages. I mean, they paid, you know, they paid not only the principal that was owed, but also back interest that was owed, back taxes and things like that. Then they turned around and they would take that amount and they would refinance it for the borrower. So the borrower still owed the full amount of what they'd owed originally. And then, but they gave them a much better interest rate and they lengthened the loan. So that actually helped them quite a bit. So a lot of borrowers actually, you know, they helped a lot of borrowers. And a lot of the New Deal, if you look at the individuals who got helped, they definitely got helped. It's just a question of how big the spillover effects are for everybody else. Are they negative or positive? So anyway, so what we have is this was a bailout for lenders. That's what Jonathan found. And so he was one of my co-authors on the book because he grouped together with another fellow named Ken Snowden to write this book. And they helped the borrowers. They helped the lenders. And then what they did was that the big question was, is what it was going to cost the government. And there was enormous uncertainty when they did this in 1933, 1934, and 35, because they just did not know if this was going to be a successful program or not. And in fact, in the first 5 years, they actually had to foreclose on 20% of the mortgages that they refinanced because people just couldn't handle it. And it wasn't until the 40s where they really got on good footing. But at the end of the day, even though the expected loss could have been as high as 30%, the actual loss was only about 2%. And another thing we found was that they weren't able to reverse the drop in home prices and the reverse in home ownership, but they were able to stop it dead in the middle of the 30s, which is a feat in and of itself. Because if they hadn't done this, it probably would have continued downward even further. And so in that sense, the HOLC was pretty good. If I was to pick winners among the New Deal programs, because there are a bunch of New Deal programs, they probably established like 100 new programs in various ways, either regulation or spending and things like this. Among the big ones, the public works and relief, I think, were relatively successful. They actually saved a lot of lives in terms of reducing infant mortality and reducing mortality from some diseases that could be prevented by just giving people better nutrition and better protection. AAA, I'm not real fond of, the farm program. It seemed like something that helped some farmers at the expense of a bunch of other farmers. Mm-hmm. And it has a mixed story because the conservation activities were actually quite good.
And the HOLC?
I thought the HOLC, I think that was a pretty good success.
Okay, hang on just a moment, and we'll try and narrow in on this idea of whether the New Deal was a success. And okay. We'll also contrast it with the Great Recession of 2008, which you did in your paper. How successful was the New Deal? We'll have more with Professor Price Fishback in just one moment. Money Radio. Thank you so much for joining us today. Our guest is Price Fishback, professor of economics, University of Arizona, and a specialist when it comes to economic history and specifically the New Deal. And you wrote a new paper, How Successful Was the New Deal? As we try to figure it out, you mentioned something just a moment ago about how some of these programs really made a difference in infant mortality. And I think that has to be one of the key things that we address. Mortality versus federal spending, that has to be something that you could look at and say, well, that's an area of success.
Oh, definitely. And so we did a study where we looked at 114 cities over like an 11-year period. And what we tried to look at was that the Great Depression itself actually stopped the decline in infant mortality and made birth rates lower. And so we did a study where we looked at all these different cities, which got different amounts of New Deal spending, and then we looked at what the effect was on the mortality rates. And so what we found was is actually had a very positive effect in reducing infant mortality. So for about every $2 million they spent in terms of modern dollars, we converted to modern dollars, that was associated with saving an infant's life. And for some other diseases, it actually was associated with reducing some contagious diseases. The mechanism came from giving mothers and infants better nutrition, and also they didn't have to worry as much about, you know, having a roof over their heads and things along those lines.
Sure.
And also some of the benefits came because the money was spent on sanitation facilities and things like that, extending sanitation and water treatment facilities and things along those lines. And so it was a very positive effect.
Now, next question as we wrap it up here. How similar was the Great Depression to the Great Recession, and what are the best lessons we can learn from the Great Depression?
Well, so the Great Recession is nowhere near as bad as the Great Depression. Great Recession, basically, real GNP fell about 3% or 4% in the year where we had a downturn. And the unemployment rate just barely touched 10% at some point. If you look at the Great Depression, we had real income or real GDP in 1932 and again in 1933 were 30% lower than what they had been in 1929. And so we didn't get back to the same 1929 GDP level until like 1937. In per capita terms, it wasn't until 1939. The unemployment rates were above 20% for 4 years. So, the Great Depression was just absolutely a disaster. And Great Recession was a problem. I mean, there's no doubt about that. But it just pales in comparison.
And the lessons learned.
Among the lessons we learned was that one of the reasons that the Great Depression got so deep was that the Federal Reserve was kind of late in responding to the problems that they'd faced. And so they thought that they had lowered the interest rates and things enough to help offset it, but it turns out we had enormous deflation at the time. And so if you looked at real interest rates, they were as high as 10 or 12% after you adjust for inflation. So Ben Bernanke, when he became head of the Fed, I mean, he promised Milton Friedman, who discovered all these things, that there's no doubt we will never let this happen again. And so they really loaded up and unleashed a lot of liquidity, the Federal Reserve did, during the 2008 when all the problems were going on. And then they bought a huge amounts of mortgage-backed securities. So that was one of the lessons learned. The Obama stimulus package, one of the things they tried to do was stimulate things to try to have an effect. And some of the multiplier estimates for those have come in about 1 to 1.5. Some people say it was as low as 0.6. So there's a lot of range of multiplier estimates there.
Kind of similar, though.
Kind of similar, and so not the big boost you might expect.
Yeah.
And one of the issues for the stimulus package was a lot of the money didn't come out in 2009. It actually came out in 2010 and 11 after the recession had come. It was over. So that was probably less successful.
Professor Fishback, we're out of time, but I guess the question, how successful was the New Deal? Not just a simple answer.
Definitely not.
We're looking forward to the book then.
Oh, yes, definitely. It's coming someday.
Someday. In the meanwhile, we have a new paper, How Successful Was the New Deal? Professor Price Fishback joining us from the University of Arizona. And it's always a pleasure to get together and talk with you about some of the history of economics. Thank you so much.
Well, great. Thank you.